regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. I'm glad to be back behind the microphone. I apologize for being away most of last week, dealing with a situation here at home. Things have stabilized, I guess, is the best word for it. Not sure that the situation's been resolved, but yeah, stabilized anyway. So anyway, I do apologize for my absence, but I am glad to be back. Glad that you are with me. We've got a lot to talk about, including the shootings over the weekend, one in North Carolina at a popular waterfront bar, one at a Mormon church in Michigan, in which the suspect then set fire to the church, at least four people dead, but officials have not accounted for everybody in that church. We will be talking a little bit more about that later on in the program, but I also want to bring in our guest today. So it's interesting. There's been this idea floated, I think, first by Firearms News Editor-in-Chief Vincent DeNiro. This was echoed by David Kadria. The President Donald Trump should order the ATF to declare all imported semi-automatic rifles as sporting, which is what domestically produced semi-automatic rifles are referred to in you know, under law. My colleague at Bearing Arms, Tom Knighton, wrote a piece echoing these calls. And then I heard from Mark Overstreet. Now, Mark, for years and years, was the senior research coordinator at NRA's Institute for Legislative Action. He actually retired back in 2016. And Mark wrote in and said, hey, you know, would you like a contrary point of view? Because I disagree, and I've got some ideas why. And I said, sure, absolutely. So I published Mark's column today, and I wanted to have Mark on the show. Mark does not disagree with what De Niro and Kadria and Tom Knighton want to do. He just thinks that there's a better way to go about it, and a need to go about it in a different way. So with that in mind, let's kick off the conversation with Mark Overstreet. Take a look and a listen. Mark, thanks very much for coming on the program. It's good to see you.
Good to see you, Cam. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. It has been a while since we've talked, but I was so pleased to get your email. And I really appreciate, you know, the column that you gave Bearing Arms, because this is an important issue, right? I mean, when we're talking again about commonly owned semi-automatic firearms, this is an issue that the Supreme Court is dealing with, but we're still at the state level. You've got, Democrats who are trying to ban these firearms, both domestically produced and those that are imported. And so I guess it's been maybe a couple of weeks now. Vincent DeNiro at Firearms News said that President Trump should order the ATF to declare all imported semi-automatic firearms as sporting, which is, as you say, what these same models that are produced domestically are considered. This is an idea that's been, supported by David Kadria. My colleague Tom Knighton at Bearing Arms agreed with this as well. But you say that it sounds like you agree with what you want the outcome to be, right? We do need to deal with these imported firearms, but you say that President Trump should not simply declare these arms to be sporting, right? Because that doesn't really get to the crux of the problem.
Right. I was thinking about how to discuss this. I think at the outset, we have to decide, or we should. I think we should decide individually, are we going to come at this particular question from the standpoint of a gun collector or a hobbyist who says, oh, boy, I might be able to go back to 1989 and buy, I don't know, a Beretta AR-70 or one of the other foreign-made rifles that BATF banned the importation of, or are we going to come at it from a Second Amendment perspective? And of course, the Second Amendment, I don't have to tell you, is not about gun collecting and having a hobby. It's about, are we going to be armed for defense against tyranny if we have to be armed for defense against tyranny? And the important thing along those lines right now is not changing 925D3, the provision that controls what kind of rifles can be imported. What's important is the assault weapon ban challenges and the magazine greater than 10 round magazine ban challenges that are eventually going to make their way to the Supreme Court. And then the more recent challenges that two different coalitions of gun groups, one the NRA and their people, and the Firearms Policy Center and American Suppressor Association, and then the other group being led by Gun Owners of America, challenging these NFA restrictions on suppressors and short-barreled rifles and short-barreled shotguns. It's more important that we win on those things than getting the BATF-E to do something about 923. It's 1989 and 1998 reinterpretations of that provision to somehow allow these foreign manufacturers to once again produce rifles. In fact, they might not even produce. It's kind of hard to imagine Beretta tooling up again to make the AR-70. And some of the other manufacturers to tool up to make those guns. I mean, that's a long time ago, 1989. And if the purpose is to, that we should get behind is to be armed for defense against tyranny, and you're talking about mostly 5.56 caliber rifles, semi-automatic with a detachable magazine and so on, we already have the best one made in this country, the AR-15. So from a practical standpoint, unless you're a gun collector and you just want to have a cool toy, from a practical standpoint, I think the value in doing something about 925D3 is how we get Trump to do it. And the goal there is to get him to say things, or get the BATF-E to say things that will encourage the Supreme Court to overturn those bans and the NFA restrictions on the right basis. And they're not going to do that if anybody's talking about sports, because the Second Amendment's not about sports, and the Supreme Court's said many times it's not about it. Well, they haven't said it's not about sports. They've said what it is about is defense.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, right? So, in fact, I'm going to be writing a piece later today about the Brady campaign, and I think one of the other gun control groups here, Brady and Giffords. This is a case involving a knife rights out in the Ninth Circuit. And they're arguing in an amicus brief, quote, arms must be in common use for lawful self-defense to be protected under the Second Amendment, which is also wrong. What the Supreme Court has said is that, you know, self-defense is the, might be the core purpose of the Second Amendment, but the Second Amendment protects the keeping and bearing of arms for lawful purposes, including self-defense, right? And that would include sport, but also, as you say, that would include defense against tyranny. Costas Moros, who's with the Second Amendment Foundation, wrote a Law Review article. I think it was in the University of Wyoming Law Review, where he talked about that very thing, right? Where the court should not ignore that one of the fundamental purposes for the Second Amendment is, again, to serve as a check on tyranny, right? An armed populace, all you have to do is go back and read the Federalist Papers. An armed populace was deemed to be a safeguard against the formation of a tyrannical government, but also, if God forbid, a tyrannical government ever arose, that was one component about how we, the people, would be able to fight back against a tyrannical government. I think James Madison, I think it's Federalist 46, talks about, you know, the body of the people capable of bearing arms, working with their state governments, right, could serve as that check on tyranny. And so,
Alexander Hamilton in Federalist number 29 is very important along those lines.
Okay. So, you know, I agree with you that that has to be a part of the discussion. It might not be something that the Supreme Court wants to wrestle with at this point, but I think that you're right when we. When we talk about, you know, limiting these arms to a sporting purpose, that's not why we have the Second Amendment. So what do you think that, what do you think Donald Trump could do? I mean, again, given the political realities, right? You've got a Congress where the Senate doesn't have 60 votes to pass anything.
That's right.
So you've got, you know, a narrow Republican majority in the House. It seems to me like the easiest course of action would be for the executive branch to do something. So what can President Trump do? What can the ATF do that would, as you say, bolster the arguments that we're making to the Supreme Court about the constitutionality of these arms?
Well, let's go back to 1989 and then look at a couple of other instances moving forward. ATF will do whatever the president tells them to do. in 1989, you know, previous, they had approved the importation of all these different rifles. Mm-hmm. And then President G.H.W. Bush told them, change that. So they did what they were told. And then when Clinton got to be president, he told them to do something about, quote unquote, assault pistols in 1993 and about street sweeper shotgun and Striker 12 shotgun in 1994. And in 1998, he told them to do something more about imported semi-automatic rifles. And they did exactly what they were told. All of this comes from being ordered to do so. It's not, there may be some people in the BATFE that would like to do these things, but they don't do it until they're told to do it. And the same thing with Trump telling them to do something about bump stocks to prevent the Republicans in Congress from having to vote on legislation to ban bump stocks. They do what they're told, and they'll do what they're told in this instance. And so, as I said in the article, I think what he has to do is tell them to rescind their 1989 and 1998 reinterpretations of 925D3, the sporting purposes import language, and explain why. And that's the important part. Because again, Beretta is not going to retool, I don't think, to make the AR-70. And, you know, we're not going to see remanufacture of the old guns from 1989. But we can derive some benefit depending on how he gets them to report on what they're going to do. So if he tells them, listen, I want you to say we've reconsidered because we realize the Second Amendment is about defense and not sports, and we realize that now that these rifles in question are, as the law says, particularly useful and readily adaptable to sports, and we were wrong when we dismissed defensively oriented marksmanship competitions, and we were wrong when we said this, and we were wrong when we said that, to encourage the Department of Justice, Attorney General Pam Bondi, Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, Harmeet Dhillon, and very importantly, to encourage the lawyers who are going to be representing our side before the Supreme Court on these challenges to the assault weapon and magazine bans and the challenges to the NFA restrictions, to say the right thing. And my fear, and not this will get off into a tangent, but my fear is that the lawyers will go in there and say, look, the Supreme Court said in Heller that what counts is whether the arm in question is in common use. Well, assault weapons are in common use, magazines are in common use, and in the Smith & Wesson versus Mexico case of just a couple of months ago, and the majority opinion wasn't a majority opinion, it was a unanimous opinion written by, of all people, Justice Kagan, who's usually against us, acknowledged that AR-15s, AK-47s, and for whatever reason, she said 50 caliber rifles. She didn't say common, but she said they're widely used or they're popular or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, slam dunk, we win because they're common. But what happens when you get to the NFA? Are suppressors common? Are short-barreled rifles common? And I hearken back to the oral arguments in District of Columbia versus Heller in the exchange between Justice Scalia, who ended up writing majority opinion, and the Solicitor General Walter Dellinger, where Dellinger was bellyaching about the fact that if you adopted the lower court's interpretation of the Second Amendment, it might mean you can't ban M16s. And Scalia said, well, how many people own fully automatic, privately own fully automatic firearms? And Dellinger said, 100,000 or so. And Scalia said, well, I don't think that's common. So what's common? Handguns were common in Heller because how many handguns are there? 100 million, 200 million, a billion, who knows? It's so many. But the numbers for assault weapons are like 20 or 25, maybe 30 million. Lots, of course, magazines are in the billions. But you might be able to convince the court to go with the common argument on assault weapons and magazines. But when you get to suppressors, there are not as many suppressors. There's not as many short-barreled rifles. There's not as many short-barreled shotguns as there are AR-15s and magazines. So what we need is a standard to offer to the court that'll work for both of those separate challenges. And my concern there is You remember what happened in District of Columbia versus Heller? Is Alan Gurr was representing our side in that, and during the oral arguments, he threw the rest of the Second Amendment under the bus just to get a win on handguns. I forget which justice asked him about art. Well, can some guns be banned? And basically, his argument was, yeah, just, you can't ban handguns, but you can ban other things. And I think maybe Ginsburg or someone said, well, like what? And he said, well, machine guns. So he was willing to throw fully automatic firearms under the bus, just give him a win on handguns. You know, and lawyers are paid to win. And they're paid to win on the case they're arguing right now, not what somebody else is going to have to worry about 10 years or 20 years from now. And my fear is this common use argument in Breyer. Justice Breyer, who was against us in Heller, he's the one that made the best point on it. He filed a dissenting opinion. He said, what you're saying is, if somebody invents a new, very effective weapon, as long as you hurry up and ban it before it gets out there and becomes common, you can do that. But if you let it get to be common, then you can't ban that. And he said, that's, you're looking to determine what can be banned by looking at what is already banned. And he said, the framers of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, did not intend circular logic like that. That's one of the clear arguments against the common use standard. And another would be raised in the Third Circuit. And in the argument, which was a New Jersey's ban, I guess, maybe a couple of months ago, where someone said, what if a gun is common to start with, but then at some point it falls out of use and is no longer common? Does that mean it's no longer entitled to Second Amendment protection? And so you think about, well, muskets in the founding era were common, but are they now? No. Does that mean you don't have a right to a musket, or you don't have a right to a Krag 30-40, or you know? So there's so many problems with the common use argument that I'm afraid that if we go in there and say, listen, you said in Heller, common use, and we're willing to go with that. So just give us assault weapons and magazines based on common. The court might say, yeah, well, fine. We'd like to honor our previous opinion. Sorry about the jet. We don't want to get creative here. We'll just do what we did before. And that's what they'll go with. And a concern there is Justice Kavanaugh, who, for whatever reason, in his statement about the Supreme Court's decision to not take the Snope case, mm-hmm. you know, whether it was a couple of months ago, they decided to not take the Snope case of challenging Maryland's assault weapon ban. Justice Thomas said he wanted to take it, and Justice Gorsuch said he wanted to take it. But Justice Kavanaugh wrote this lengthy explanation for why he thought.
Mark, I think we've got you back, sir.
I got disconnected for a second. I was just going to say, Kavanaugh is, for whatever reason, is big on this stare decisis and precedent. But to me, you know, maybe this is an oversimplification, but the Supreme Court likes precedent when it allows them to do what they want to do. But if we always deferred to what the Supreme Court did previously, we'd still have Plessy v. Ferguson. We'd still have Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey. We would still have, what's the other one? I forget. But there have been several landmark Supreme Court cases that have been overturned because the more modern courts said they were wrong. Mm-hmm. So I don't know why Justice Kavanaugh would be averse to saying that, for example, Heller is wrong in saying that the right to arms is limited to what's common.
Yeah, well, and I think when you get there, it's probably going to be more than just Justice Kavanaugh too, right? And maybe some of that is just the length of time between Heller and now. I mean, you go back to Roe versus Wade, that was, you know, 50 years ago before that was overturned. Plessy versus Ferguson, obviously, an even longer period of time. Dred Scott was another case that was, if not overturned, at least, you know, undermined by a later Supreme Court action. But I think your broader point is right, that the common use argument, and we're already actually seeing this in some of these NFA challenges, right, where groups like FPC, GOA, NRA are arguing that, well, actually, suppressors are in common use. There are millions of lawfully owned suppressors. But the other argument is that, you know, you go back to Miller, the 1939 case, right, about short-barreled shotguns, not having any utility in militia service. I think, you know, we're now starting to see people cite the Miller decision as saying, look, the Supreme Court said as long as there is a relationship, as long as these items are useful in militia service, then they're protected arms, right? And we're seeing that argument being made for short-barreled rifles, basically for anything not a short-barreled shotgun, because that was the one arm in question that the Supreme Court said did not have a militia purpose. And so I think that we are starting to see these arguments, if not move away from common use, they still have to recognize that that is what the court said. But I think we're also starting to see, again, these additional arguments being made that the Second Amendment is not just about individual self-defense. That might be the core purpose, according to Scalia. But that's not the only intended purpose. And one of the fundamental reasons why we have a Second Amendment right, and you go back to 1776, the Pennsylvania State Constitution, you go back to the arguments over ratification. Yes, there was concern about people being able to protect themselves as individuals, but there was also that concern about the security of a free state, right? And people being able to bear arms in defense of themselves and the state, which I think is what the language of the 1776 Pennsylvania Constitution said. And so that, too, Mark, I think gets to your point about we do need to be able to make these arguments that don't solely revolve around whether an arm is in common use for lawful purposes. Because you're right. At some point, I mean, we're already seeing this, right? We're already seeing courts say, well, suppressors aren't in common use. Short-barreled rifles are not in common use. Machine guns are not in common use. So we are going to have to make that argument. You note in your column that the DOJ is taking the position that AR-15s are protected by the Second Amendment, which is the first time that the DOJ has taken that position. So, you know, the argument that you lay out makes a lot of sense in terms of what the Trump administration is already doing, the language that it's already deploying. But to sort of get ahead of the game here, right, to not just be reactive to, OK, there's this lawsuit going on in the Seventh Circuit, or there's this lawsuit going on in the Ninth Circuit, or the Third Circuit in New Jersey's case. But what are these cases that are just now being filed? What are the cases that will be filed in the coming years? And what can we do as an administration to, again, make sure that we're bolstering and protecting the right to keep and bear arms? I think what you laid out, the steps that the President Trump could take from an executive action standpoint, frankly, they make a lot of sense in terms of, again, following through with President Trump's executive order to strengthen and secure our Second Amendment rights, to direct this administration and the agencies to take whatever steps necessary to secure those rights. I think the language that you laid out is right in line with what President Trump's already said.
Well, I wasn't really arguing with President Trump so much as I was arguing with the idea of just sporting. But may I add this?
Sure.
You know, we're in a box, and everyone knows what I mean when I say step out of the box. Sometimes we say we'll take two steps back and look at the big picture, forest for the trees and all of that. First of all, the entire Bill of Rights is about defense against tyranny. It's not that the other nine amendments are about defense against tyranny, but the Second Amendment is only about defense against some common criminal. And so Scalia was wrong in Heller, but he was deliberately wrong because he wanted to make the argument to validate the 1986 ban on possession of a fully automatic firearm manufactured after May 19th of 1986. The other thing, thinking outside the box, or the second thing, is that the framers, you know, the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, by standards of their day, were radical. Imagine the idea of that the rights come from your creator and governments can do only what the people authorize the governments to do. Can you imagine how the heads burst overseas when these kings read this stuff? And so nowadays, the anti-gun people, well, you know, the founding fathers couldn't conceive of an AR-15 or whatever. The framers didn't say the right of the people to keep and bear militia arms, or the right of the people to keep and bear common arms. He said arms. It's a pretty radical thing. You know, in Madison, like you mentioned in Federalist 46, he said the governments overseas are afraid to trust their people with arms. And he didn't go into any detail about what kind of arms. He just said arms. And I'll agree that, we don't have a right individually for a nuclear weapon, but muskets and blunderbusses and handguns of the founding era, they're the lineal descendants of those things today are really any rifle. And we get bogged down in minutia now, and starting with the National Firearms Act. Well, this rifle has a barrel of 16 inches, but this one, the barrel is the 32nd of an inch shorter. So, all of a sudden, it's a completely different firearm, or the overall length is a 32nd of an inch different. Or this one fires one shot when you pull the trigger. This one fires two shots when you pull the trigger. And then you see the same thing with all these assault weapon definitions. Well, let's see, it's got to have a semi-automatic mechanism, and it has to have a detachable magazine, and then it's got to have a pistol grip or a folding stock or adjustable length stock or bayonet lug. You can have any of those things on a gun as long as you don't have all of those things on a gun. And we're supposed to think it's very significant that that rifle over there has a bayonet lug on it.
Right.
And it should be called an assault weapon. But what about all these Lee Enfields and 1903 Springfields that have a bayonet lug? Oh, well, don't worry about those. So again, I think we need to encourage the lawyers and the courts who are going to make the decisions to not get bogged down in minutiae and just look for once. But once, they didn't do it in Miller, they didn't do it in Heller, and they really didn't do it in Bruin. Go back and say, what did the framers try to accomplish with the Second Amendment? They wanted people armed for defense against tyranny. And Alexander Hamilton, in Federalist 29, he said that the idea would be that the people would be little, quote unquote, little, if at all, inferior in the use of arms to regular troops, he used the term. So how are we to be little, if all, inferior to regular troops if we can't remotely have the same kind of firearms? And when you get down to it, a musket, a blunderbuss, and a handgun of the late 18th century, or an M16 today, a shotgun and a handgun, they're point target weapons. You aim at one target at a time and you fire your shot. That's it. It's not an area target weapon. It's not a bazooka. It's not a grenade. It's not a mortar. And so any point target firearm is a lineal descendant of the point target firearms from the founding era. And the same will be true 50 years or 100 years from now when we have the Buck Rogers ray gun that, instead of shooting an inert projectile by force of burning gunpowder, it uses a laser beam or something like that, or a Star Trek phaser. You're still going to be pointing at one target at a time. And let's move on. That's it. So that's all you need to know to find that a short barrel rifle is protected. A suppressor, which is an integral part of soldiering equipment today, is protected. AR-15 is protected. Any of the semi-automatic rifles, any automatic rifle. Now you get into a GE minigun, that's an area target weapon. That's something different. The court will have to deal with that. But, it may not have to deal with it if no one challenges it. But what's being challenged now is a ban on point target rifles and short-barreled rifles and suppressors and so on. So it ought to be pretty easy for the court to use that as a standard for finding in our favor, and not use that common use standard, which could come back to bite us in the future. Because when the Buck Rogers ray gun gets invented for real, it won't be common. And if Congress hurries up and bans it, well, that'll be all she wrote for that.
Yeah. Mark, we are unfortunately going to have to leave it there, but I cannot thank you enough again for joining me on the program today, for writing this piece for Bearing Arms. I think this is fantastic food for thought. I hope that not only our readers enjoy it, but frankly, I hope that the folks in the Trump administration and the DOJ take a look at this as well. And I would love to have your contributions in the future. So anytime you've got something to say about our right to keep and bear arms and the fight that we have to protect that right, I hope you consider Bearing Arms as a place for publication, my friend.
Well, thank you for having me. Thanks for the invitation, and keep up the good work.
Well, thank you so much, Mark. I look forward to talking to you again very soon. Mark Overstreet joining us here on Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. I appreciate Mark joining us on the program, and again, appreciate his contribution to Bearing Arms as well. And before we get to today's Armed Citizens Story, our good deed of the day and our recidivist report, I do want to talk just a little bit about what we saw this past weekend in North Carolina and in Michigan. Two targeted attacks Two individuals, apparently both military veterans. We don't know the motives for these attacks. We don't know the politics, frankly. I don't think they really matter. I have said this every time we see a high-profile shooting. I think, you know, when we're talking about twisted, deranged individuals, their motives, frankly, aren't going to make sense to a lot of us. But we do know that the gun control lobby is going to seize on these attacks. They're not going to want to talk about mental health. They're not going to want to talk about anything other than guns, quite frankly, right? And I don't think they're going to be talking. I mean, look, we'll hear calls for red flag laws, particularly in North Carolina. Michigan already has a red flag law in place. So you may hear calls to expand that red flag law, like who can report somebody, who can file a complaint. But primarily, I think this is going to renew their calls for bans on so-called assault weapons. We've already seen this in Minnesota after the shooting at the Church of the Annunciation. Governor Tim Walz says he's going to call a special session, has not done so as of yet, but he says it's coming. And again, he wants a gun ban. He can't even define what a quote-unquote assault weapon is, but he wants to ban them. We're going to see this in the days ahead, I believe, in North Carolina and in Michigan as well. So gun owners need to stay involved. You need to stay engaged. And again, I would encourage you right now to contact your lawmakers and urge them to, again, focus on things that really matter. Focus on things that can make a difference. We do have a crumbling mental health system across the country. Every state in the union has a shortage of inpatient mental health beds. This is something that it's a problem that's decades in the making. And a fix is not going to happen overnight, but we can get started at least. And that would be a far more productive way to combat these types of incidents than, again, trying to ban our way to safety. Now, with that being said, let's talk about today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day in our recidivist report from Ohio, where a man avoids jail time after a shooting in a local park. This was in March of this year. A 15-year-old boy shot multiple times. Two witnesses told police that they heard anywhere from 5 to 10 gunshots. They saw two teens running towards the basketball courts of this playground. Court documents show the police used video from the scene to identify a car driven by 21-year-old Brian Bandis. It was a Kettering, Ohio officer who arrested him that night. Police said that Bandis had a gun on him, that between the incident where the shooting took place and inside his car, they found 11 shell casings. Bandis was charged with discharge of a firearm on or near prohibited premises, as well as two counts of felonious assault. He ended up taking a plea deal, pled guilty to one count of discharge of a firearm on or near prohibited premises and one count of misdemeanor assault. And instead of going to prison, Brian Bandis got 1 year probation. That's it. 1 year probation. WHIO in Dayton says that if Bandis violates the terms of his probation, he could go to jail for 9 months to 3 years, according to court records. So maybe that's a possibility. Could, by the way, right? Not will, could go to jail. So again, you know, we hear politicians talk about we need to get serious about this. We need to get tough on these violent crimes. And then they call for a gun ban, right? Well, here you've got somebody who was charged with shooting a teenager, felonious assault, takes a plea deal, walks away with a misdemeanor, and walks away with 1 year probation. That is not getting serious about these types of violent offenses. And yet, again, outcomes like that are happening every day in courtrooms across the country. Today's Armed Citizen story from Indiana, Cumberland PD, a man killed in what they are describing as a self-defense shooting. It's happened over the weekend. According to a press release from the Cumberland Police Department, it was about 7 p.m. Sunday night. Officers were called out to a home and reported a disturbance with a weapon. When officers arrived, they say they found an adult male suffering from an apparent gunshot wound. He was taken to a hospital in Indianapolis in critical condition, but later passed away. According to a preliminary investigation, police believe that the incident was a disturbance between an adult male and an adult female. Police initially detained the woman, but later released her. They say the woman claimed self-defense. As a result, police are not actively looking for suspects. Again, the woman was not arrested, so it appears that there was evidence at the scene that backed up her account. Cumberland PD says it has spoken with the Marion County Prosecutor's Office, but they've not yet formally presented a case at this time. They will present their findings to the DA's office, but again, if this was, as police apparently believe, an act of self-defense, and I would not expect any charges to be filed, but we'll see if we can find any more information for you in the coming days. Finally, today, our good deed of the day in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A driver in Arizona who helped some stranded drivers from floodwaters. There was, a monsoon in the Phoenix area over the weekend. This happened in, Globe, Arizona. Jarvis Johnson describes himself as a people person. He says, I love people because I believe that everybody has a story. It was back on September 26th. He saw two women stuck in their car in the floodwaters. And he said, I had to make a hesitation to stand on the side or get in the game. And I got in the game. He was actually on his way home from the hospital. His wife had just given birth to their son. He was going to see their other kids when his car stalled out in the water. He said, I'd never seen water like that before. So he's waiting for AAA to show up. And then he says he heard this cry for help. He said this lady was sticking her head out the window on the other side of the road. She stuck a whole body out the window and she's like, help us, help us. He said, so I ended up, I took everything out of my pocket. I got in the water. And he says, as I got in the water, I slipped. I hit the guardrail. I lost my glasses. He said, but I wasn't thinking about that. All I was thinking about was this lady needs help. Keep going. So he was actually able to pull that woman out of the car, carried her through the floodwaters, actually carried a companion out of the car through the floodwaters as well. And he said when he was done, he went and found more people to help, working with strangers to save them. He said, black, white, Mexican, every race you could think of really out there, all helping strangers in need. Jarvis apparently lost his car. Some folks have started a GoFundMe campaign to help him raise money to replace it. But he says he's not a hero. He says, I just think I'm a regular person that did what almost anybody else in their right mind would have gotten out there and done. Johnson is also a Uber driver. He went on to help several other people that day. That GoFundMe designed to raise money to get him a new car. Some of the women that have that he helped have actually donated. And I hope that Jarvis is able to replace his vehicle, but again, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing for strangers in need. We thank you for your very, very good deed. Jarvis Johnson there in Arizona. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. I want to thank you as always for being a part of the program. I'm looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. Knock on wood that life doesn't throw me any more curveballs. I think we're going to be okay. But anyway, until we talk again, be sure to check out BearingArms.com, by the way, throughout the rest of the day. We're keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. If you like what you see, I'd also encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum member. Use the promo code FIGHT, and you can get 60% off your membership. You'll get all kinds of great benefits at every tier of support, and we certainly do appreciate your support for our Second Amendment coverage. Have a great rest of your Monday. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well. Be safe and be free.